This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Make sure you stick around because later in the episode, we'll break down today's biggest stories in the Chicago area. Now, before we continue, I want you to know that this episode will discuss intimate partner violence and may include references of physical and psychological abuse or death. Now, if you are someone that you know needs assistance, call the Illinois Domestic Violence Helpline at 877-2-END-DV or 877-863-6338. Now, after several recent high-profile domestic violence cases that ended in tragedy, many people are asking what more could have been done and what resources are actually available to prevent this kind of violence. Here in Illinois, there have been changes in laws, services, and awareness, but there are still challenges. So how do these systems work when someone is in serious danger? And if you're a friend or family member, how can you step in safely? At the table, a panel of local experts to discuss. Smriti Shukla handles Programs Manager Advocacy Services for APNAGAR, which works to end gender-based violence in immigrant communities. Roslyn Romero is a supervisor of outreach and prevention for Pillars Community Health in the western suburbs. And Mabel Tapler is an adult women's program coordinator for the Rosenthal Family Lodge Shelter at Family Rescue. This is on the city's southeast side. Now, since domestic violence can take many forms, Roslyn starts us off by describing some of the identifiers that she looks out for. Here's Roslyn.
First, there are many forms of abuse. I think, some of them are physical abuse. You know, some of the worst ones are actually emotional abuse because they go unseen. And like I said, it's not always physical where you can see actual bruising but individuals will talk to you, right? So the best way to identify is just to be that listening ear to, you know, hear an individual out. Maybe they're not immediately telling you, like, these are the type, like, this is what I'm going through, or like physically showing anything. But
right.
Yeah. So I would say.
Anything to add, Smriti, about what you look for when it comes to domestic violence? How can you tell?
One of the things that we particularly notice when service seekers call us is that they are asking for questions services that they are aware of. So we have to ask them a little bit more questions to understand why did they call the service line specifically to seek support, help them understand confidentiality practices. And also, once we explain confidentiality and we normalize the control component of the community of domestic violence, we tend to see more information coming from the service seeker, showing us different aspects. So one of the things about signs that we definitely see is that it will be hard to gather information in the first instance. There will be a lot of you'd have to have more questions, create a space, safe space, and warm up.
So they're not readily sharing all of the information right off the bat.
It's going to take a while for them to open up. So it's important to inform them of confidentiality and resources.
Tell me about this, because something that I know gets in the way is this feeling of self-doubt or self-blame. How do you work with survivors who think that the abuse is their fault?
First off is to explain to them that they are not alone in the process. Two is to also normalize that it's okay to feel that, but what is not all right is the control that they're experiencing. and the right and the fact that they don't have choice and agency to exercise those choices. So it's usually helpful to kind of speak to them a little mm-hmm. bit more about what those choices are and go slow, because self-doubt is something that we all experience,
right,
whether we're experiencing abuse or not directly. It's something that we all experience. So it's naming some of these things that we experience culturally, maybe religiously, maybe based on social norms, naming them to the survivor, it helps to demystify it.
Yeah. Mabel, what comes to mind when you've had to help folks in the past understand that this is not their fault?
Well, first of all, you got to understand they're grieving a relationship. That's one thing. And let them know it's okay to grieve that relationship. You was with your partners perhaps for years.
Mm-hmm.
And so providing that domestic violence education and knowledge and giving them that understanding that it's okay to feel how you feel.
And what can people expect when they call that hotline number? I gave a number at the top of this conversation, but there are multiple, right? We have the Illinois, we have Chicago, there's a national number, there's one that you can text. Mm-hmm. What makes the most sense for folks here in our area to dial, and what can they expect when they actually call the number? What's on the other end?
I would say the Illinois Domestic Violence Hotline. So when a caller is looking for shelter, they will call the hotline. They will speak to the specialist at the hotline. And the specialist will obtain information, that's name, are you single, family, so forth. And then after those questions are answered, then if, like Family Rescue, if we have availability, they will call our crisis line, speak to an experienced advocate, and then the intake process will start from there.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the legal aspects of this. I mean, what do people need to know about orders of protection, Roz, and how can those help? How can you get an order of protection put in place?
Sure. So in order to start the process, I would say the first thing would do for what individuals should do for us would be to call the 708 Pillars. And once they call 708 Pillars, they would be then helped with different resources that we provide. Pillars Community Health definitely focuses on whole person care. So we focus on integrated care. So when an individual does call, they are not navigating all these different services or different systems.
Mm-hmm.
And so we offer everything in one community health center. So we offer, you know, primary mental care. We also offer behavioral health. We offer legal medical advocacy within domestic violence and sexual assault, clinical therapy services for not just current immediate needs, but also long-term, you know, healing process. We offer community outreach. So there's within that, I say the first step would be just to contact the 708 Pillars, and mm-hmm. then we'd be able to help them to legal medical advocacy. And so what to expect is they would have a team of advocates that are, you know, ready to help support them in any way they mm-hmm. can, as far as throughout the dealing throughout the processes of the legal or court system.
And you connect them with attorneys?
Yes.
To be able to take it to the next step. What services exist, Smriti, to help people navigate the court process?
Absolutely. So we have legal advocacy programs across the city as well as in the burbs. The purpose of this program is to where a trauma-informed, culturally competent advocate sits down with this service seeker to help them draft the order of protection petition, explain to them what this process is and what to expect in court, because just filing the petition itself isn't enough. There will be court dates coming in the next 14 days or 21 days as the judge decides.
Mm-hmm.
And the service seeker who is going to apply for the order of protection needs to be aware of what the next steps are going to entail. For order of protection, I would like to insist that the initial petition that goes in is very, very crucial. Although there are resources available, so there are advocates available at the courthouse as well. Most of the courthouses have advocates.
Okay.
There are attorneys who can provide support in drafting the order of protection and representing in the order of protection proceedings. The initial petition is important because that is what the plenary order of protection is dependent on.
Okay.
And sometimes amendment or continuing the order of protection as an emergency or an interim can become challenging if the original petition does not contain crucial facts for the judge to decide on.
Interesting. And you, there's another layer too with the work you do, Smriti, because you are, as I said, you're dealing with immigrant communities primarily. Yeah. So how do you address concerns that they might have about coming for help, and that may be causing, you know, harm to their immigration process?
Well, the fear is real. It is valid, and it is one of the most powerful tools that the abusers have used to control survivors. I would say that our job as advocates is to name the fear, mm-hmm. because naming itself dispels some of the power that it has over the survivor. The second piece is to ensure the survivor and inform them that safety is a human right. It is not something that is determined on what documentation a person may have. Secondly, the legal system that addresses the order of protection, the civil court cases, is a separate process. The judges there are not immigration judges, and they are not going to look for documents to kind of decide whether order of protection should be provided or not. Secondly,
that's good to know.
Illinois also has a very strong confidentiality law, which protects these court orders and the communications that take place. So survivor seeking help does not trigger immigration. And if survivor does not reach for help, it often leaves them isolated and more vulnerable in such situations.
Mabel, what are some different factors that you consider when you are also trying to navigate helping a survivor with an order of protection, advising them on how to move forward in that legal process?
Well, I believe these beautiful ladies, they discussed it very awesomely, but also we have a great legal advocacy team at Family Rescue, and we referred our advocates to them.
Mm-hmm. Roz, tell us about the medical support at Pillars. You talked a little bit about that there for service seekers, but what should people keep in mind if they do need medical care because of domestic abuse?
The most important thing is that the services are there, they're available, and we are, ready to help and jump in any time. It's a whole person care, so we focus on immediate health needs as well as individuals that come to us if they've been, recently abused. There's a whole process for, hospitals and the advocacy team to, mm-hmm. To work together. But the main thing is just to reach out. That's the first step, I would say, just to reach out, get a hold of one of our, through one of our 24-hour hotlines, whether it's domestic violence or sexual assault.
And, we talked about Pillars being in the western suburbs, but Smriti, do these kinds of companion medical support services exist here in the city?
Absolutely. Apnagar works very closely with Hamdard Health. We work with Swedish TV program. We work with Tapestry 360 Health, Trellis, Rush UIC Advocate also have a sexual assault nurse examiner programs. It is important to provide culturally competent support to service seekers that come to the health setting, because that's usually the first place where abuse and abuse is being identified. I would like to mention that a lot of immigrant communities, Black and LGBTQI plus communities, have experienced re-traumatization in the medical spaces. So it's really important that the providers understand the cultural and the community dynamics that kind of guides decisions for the patient. It's important to provide language support when they come to seek medical help. Mm-hmm. It is also important to understand that not everyone is ready to take action right away. So education and awareness is important, and to go with their pace. But yes, Chicago does have a lot of good trauma-informed medical programs.
Mabel, back to you. The Illinois Domestic Violence Hotline, it reported record numbers of calls last year, right? It's straining the system, it seems like. Are there currently beds available?
That's a good question. Well, with Family Rescue, we have 36 beds. Unfortunately, we have individuals that call for shelter, and we try to accommodate them the best way we know how. Mm-hmm. But due to shortage of domestic violence beds, we do try to work with them to brainstorm. That's meaning, do you have a friends and family to reside with? If we do have funds available, we do temporarily put clients into hotels.
Okay. So you're seeing, I'm wondering if you're seeing an increase too, Roz, of people coming to your shelters.
Yes, I would say over the last 3 months, we've seen an increase of individuals coming from the Chicago area. And as far as our shelter, Constance Morris House, we offer 11 rooms total. And they all have private full bathrooms. And then we have two full, fully accessible rooms as well. And I would say each room can hold a capacity of up to 4 individuals per room. Yeah, and just to add on, you know, there's definitely a shortage with, you know, all the several domestic violence calls coming through the hotline.
And Smriti, you know, keeping that in mind, there's a shortage, and in real time, people are trying to leave very tough situations, very difficult situations. How does someone not get discouraged when they get a clear sense of what's available or what's not available?
Oh, that's hard. But resourcefulness is the skill in this space. I think there are some ways that we can creatively as advocates support service seekers who reach out to us. One of the most important one is, let's not just hand off numbers. Because numbers, usually cold referrals fall through the crack all the time. It is important, as far as possible, work with the survivor while they are with you to get connected to a resource. Another thing very important is that the survivors typically have called multiple numbers and have recognized, okay, I need an attorney, or I need to move to a shelter. When they're reaching out to you and you have shelter space, like Apnagar does have 31 beds for shelter, and we provide emergency housing. But we do, at the hotline, work with the service seeker to dive a little bit more deeper into what other options are available other than a shelter. That does not create more barriers for the service seeker in terms of accessing resources for safety and stability. Mm-hmm. So it's really, really important that we work with more options with the survivor, just so that they are not... they're not hearing a no because that resource is not available. Additionally, one other thing that I do want to add here is that it is important that the survivors are connected to material resources right away. Transportation resources, childcare resources, gift cards, because economic independence is really the deciding factor mm-hmm. on what next steps the service seeker is going to take.
This one is for all the people listening, especially, you know, those who maybe know someone going through this. What if your loved one is experiencing abuse? What do you do?
I like the 3 R's: recognize, respond, and refer.
Tell me more.
So recognizing that your loved one, there's been a shift. There's isolation, less communication. Their appearances is not up to par. What I say is, well, come with love, no judgment. They're already going through a hard time. And they perhaps don't even know they're in a domestic violence relationship. Well, what I do recommend for a loved one is to call your local organization and reach out to an advocate. And so you can obtain the knowledge to bring back to your loved one.
Is this something you deal with as well, Roz? Folks who are maybe reporting this on behalf of someone they know and love?
Yes, definitely. I would say, you know, just being that listening ear and offering a safe and non-judgmental space for that survivor, for that victim of either domestic violence or sexual assault. One thing I have learned over the years is you might want it so bad for that individual, right, to get the help that they want, to get the help that you know they need. However, it takes that person to want to make that step on their own. You mm-hmm. can't force them to do that.
They have to want it.
Yes.
Absolutely.
That's tough. Yeah. Smriti, what's happening at the Illinois state level that's protecting folks right now?
Illinois actually has a lot of good laws that protect survivors, but there are also some glaring gaps. We are treating emergency housing as a solution to safety. We really need to talk about increasing more support for transitional housing and permanent supportive housing for survivors. We really need to look at expanding funding support to civil aid agencies. Attorneys are needed all the time for family law cases like custody and divorce, looking at eviction cases, looking at order protections, looking at immigration. And the need is huge, and the availability of pro bono attorneys is extremely limited. So those are some of the things that really need to be factored in at the state level.
Can I piggyback on that with the housing shortage? I definitely agree with you, because we do need more affordable housing. There needs to be a budget increase in the city of Chicago. And those are some of the deficits when clients come in. They don't have a job, might not have the job, the training to obtain the job. They've lived with their abuser, and perhaps the abuser have taken over their finances. So they come into shelter like, now what? We do, I don't know if you guys, we do the coordinated entry system is where...
What does that mean?
The coordinated entry system is where they speak to a housing specialist. They do a 30-minute assessment. The name is put on a waiting list for housing, but it's not guaranteed. So we don't know when or if when they'll be called. So those are some of the issues that we're having as well.
Just wanted to add to that having more support for language access, to have quality interpreters, to be able to get materials translated, some expanded support for that would be extremely helpful as well.
That's what you would love to see at the state level. And Ross, last word to you. What else are you looking for at the state level, or other resources that we haven't talked about yet that you wanted to share?
Sure. So I have a couple of things to add to that. So I know that as far as last year, May 11, 2025, there was a law that passed recently. It's called Katrina's Law. And so it requires the immediate removal of firearms that from individuals that have been subject to orders of protection, as well as the responders to then surrender their firearms or any parts to their firearms to local law enforcement within 24 hours of the sentence, and as well as other services. So I work within outreach and prevention at my organization, and you know, we're always looking for different ways to show awareness, to show support towards victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And April is actually SAM, which is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Mm-hmm. And so we're wrapping up the month with just, you know, showing support, getting involved in any way you can, looking at our website, which is pillarscommunityhealth.org, to find ways to join events, to donate to, you know, local programs to help survivors in need.
That's Rosalind Romero, who's Supervisor of Outreach and Prevention for Pillars Community Health in the Western Suburbs. We've also been speaking with Smriti Shukla, who's Programs Manager Advocacy Services for APNAGAR, which works to end gender-based violence in immigrant communities, and Mabel Tapler, who's an Adult Women's Program Coordinator for the Rosenthal Family Lodge Shelter at Family Rescue on the city's southeast side. Now, again, if you or someone you know needs assistance, call the Illinois Domestic Violence Helpline at 877-863-6338. Recent news headlines have brought a string of domestic violence cases into the spotlight. And as these stories unfold, the way that they're reported shapes how we understand what happened and why. Too often, media coverage leans on familiar narratives, centering the male perpetrator, or on language that can hide the reality of domestic violence. So what should responsible reporting look like, and how can journalists do better? At the table to discuss, Karen Atiyah, award-winning journalist and founder of the Resistance Studies series, that's a course on race, media, and international affairs. Now, the media tends to cover domestic violence less often and with less depth than other violent crimes of similar serious nature. So first, I asked Karen to tell us her thoughts on why that happens. Here she is.
Even as we're talking about this and the conversations that we've been having and that you've been having with your guests, and even the term domestic violence, I mean, in the statistically, again, not all, but statistically, the majority of those cases, domestic violence happen to be violence perpetrated against women, mm-hmm. or the women in the house. So even as you just even said, domestic violence and how it's being covered by media, the sense that domestic violence is a sort of lesser priority, that domestic violence is not a high crime in many ways, right? And I think there's so many, and for my part, you know, I spent the majority of my time, you know, in the media when I was at the Washington Post as an opinion columnist. So I got the birth, the range, the permission in a lot of ways to challenge even how we think about the language that we use when we are talking about violence against women. Mm-hmm. And so,
but that's not afforded to traditional journalism or, you know, journalists in their reporting.
Of course. So as you said in these, you know, headlines, we've seen very standard, again, centering the male perpetrator in the case out here in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area, which shocks the area, which was former Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, who shot and killed his wife, Dr. Serena Fairfax, who was a well-respected dentist here, and mm-hmm. then turned the gun on himself. His children, actually his son, I believe, called 911,
yes.
right? And of course, it sent ripple effects through the political world here. But in the initial days, the stories mostly focused on Justin Fairfax,
yes.
his career.
His fall from grace.
Quote unquote fall from grace, which was basically, you know, being accused of very serious crimes against women, sexual assault, actually. And so for me, you know, as someone who's been in the media, but also critiques the media, I was just like, once again, the centering, and understandably, Justin Fairfax had a name. He rose to power and prominence, mm-hmm. you know, running for political office. So yes, naturally, the media is going to focus on the person who has more fame, right? But it was stunning to see coverage where this, you know, his wife, this woman who had a whole life, who had a whole career, was just, and his wife.
Yeah,
his,
yeah. And, you know. And I'm glad you brought up the Justin Fairfax example, because, I mean, you write about this in depth on your Substack called The Golden Hour. And you talk about how, you know, that whole focus on the career and then the fall from grace, how there's even more interest in this type of framing when the domestic violence perperpetrator is a Black man. Mm-hmm. Explain that.
Yeah, I mean, I think Justin Fairfax and part of it, right, is that in general, when it comes to men, when it comes to, you know, quote unquote, family men, we know that being a family man, being a husband, being a father carries a certain level of social privilege with it,
mm-hmm.
In normal life, that women, motherhood, wifehood does not afford the same types of social privilege, right? So that is how things go when life is normal. But in the event of a crime, I think there's multiple elements at play, right? People were fascinated. People in general are fascinated by this idea of a Black man who's risen to power in a white world, and then ostensibly, depending on how you look at it, either threw it all away because he can't sort of control his urges around mm-hmm. women, or framing women as an obstacle to his rise. Do you know what I mean? Mm. As if it wasn't for the scandal, which is women accusing him of using sexual violence against them, but being framed as that more so about him, and that was his downfall, and not about the women and what they went through, and what does this say about power in society, right?
And you're referencing previous instances where Justin Fairfax was accused in the past of sexual violence against women in college years and before that. Right. This is well before the murder-suicide on April 16th. So that's what you're referring to there.
Correct, correct. And I think there is a sort of a fascination. I think in general, humans tend to be fascinated with quote unquote falls from grace. Mm-hmm. Now,
we see a lot of the family man photos, right? The happier times, photos. The smiles. And this is beyond the Fairfax case, right? Mm-hmm. You see that, you know, and it's beyond black men. It happens across the board, right? The family photo, the family on the jet ski, right?
Yeah. Right.
When things were good.
When things were good, but also, again, I think for me writing, and this has been a long, almost dark internet joke, you know, that the media will tend to post the most loving, happy pictures of a man who ends up murdering his entire family, right? And so for me, it's just how male privilege works even after they're perpetrators of violence against women and children, and particularly like women and children that, you know, from a relational, sociocultural standpoint, they're supposed to protect the most. Mm-hmm. Right?
Now, there's also this tendency to speculate immediately about mental health issues, mm-hmm. right? Often the conversation goes there. When is that appropriate, Karen? And when could it be harmful?
Yeah, I think we're in a moment in a time, you know, talking about violence and mental health issues. I think what really tended to set people off in this case, particularly with the Serena Fairfax's murder. See, even me, I'm primed to reference this as Justin,
you said it yourself. He was the popular one in the relationship. Mm-hmm. We knew mm-hmm. him, covered him. I mean, I was also working in the DMV area with you years ago, also covering this man. So I understand why the automatic reference, but that's exactly what we need to stop.
Right. So I do think, you know, having discussions, yes, of course, about mental health, emotional regulation, all of that is important. However, there are multiple levels of sort of deflection and pivoting and danger with this, frankly, which is, first of all, this unfairly stigmatizes people who have mental health, mm-hmm. struggle with. The majority of people who struggle with mental health issues do not make the choice to pick up a gun to deal with their issues, to point whatever pain, whatever they're going through outwardly, right? So that's number one. Many mental health advocates have been, you know, extremely dismayed and willing to push back on that narrative. So mm-hmm. that's number one. Number two, as I wrote in my Substack, there's a study, studies that have been done on media research that tends to say that when it comes to male violence, that whether it's mass shootings, whether it's cases like this with Vice Mayor of Coral Springs, Nancy Mattier, who was killed by her husband,
right.
that we tend to sort of incorporate mitigating factors into why the man must have done this.
You know, we've got to explain it away.
He was stressed. So we were seeing that in this. He was stressed. He was depressed in the Fairfax case. Well, surely. I mean,
she was going to leave him.
She was going to leave him. She was going to take the children, all of that sort of thing. And we do know that it is statistically more risky for women to leave or divorce their partners. And that is when quite often the risk for violence gets high. So mental health or not, we know that in terms of heterosexual relationships, very specifically, that these tend to be dangerous mm-hmm. times for women who are trying to leave relationships. So, you know, it's a moment, it's a time again for us to challenge this reflex that we have to automatically want to mitigate male violence mm-hmm. against women in particular. And again, to unfairly stigmatize groups, like I said, the majority of people who struggle with mental health, the majority of women struggle with mental health issues and depression and career setbacks. But statistically, they are not the ones killing their partners. Mm.
So what should news consumers be paying attention to or questioning when they see reports on domestic violence? Mm-hmm. And how could that even inform how they talk about it in their circles?
Sure. So, you know, one thing I noted that I thought was actually journalistically really interesting in the case of Vice Mayor Nancy Mattier, who in April, same month, was shot and killed by her husband, Stephen Bowen. And one thing that, I mean, aside from how horrible that was, she was a rising star in the Democratic Party. What I saw journalistically that I actually thought was radical, to be honest, was that the family, Nancy's family, requested that Bowen, her husband's name, be dropped from her name. So she had, it was Mattier Bowen. So they referred to her as Nancy Mattier. And several news outlets actually decided to honor the family's
wishes. I did see that, yes.
Right. And I know that that is, that it just for me led to a really interesting question of, from a maybe more philosophical point of view, you know, are you still a husband? Should media still be calling you a husband if you've ended your relationship or your marriage literally by killing your wife? So for me, that was the impetus to say that. And again, I'm an opinion writer, so I get a lot of freeway.
But you also get pushback.
I also get pushback. I did get pushback, particularly from a lot of men, to be honest, who said, oh, just, you know, they're still husbands. It's whereas I think a lot of women reacting to the piece. And I think part of this is women, we feel we don't have language for what it means to specifically kill your wife, to specifically kill women. And we talk about it in blanket terms in terms of intimate partner violence. But that gives an impression that partner violence, again, talking about heterosexual relationship, that the violence is evenly divided amongst genders, right?
Okay.
So in many, I'm starting to see the use more now of the word femicide.
Yes.
Which specifically says the killing of women, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I've done work and studies about how women, when they're pregnant, they're also more likely to be killed by their partner, either while pregnant in the third trimester or within months of giving birth. We don't have language for the killing of pregnant women, even though statistically,
right,
they're more likely to be killed then. So I think for me, it's looking at, can we be more specific with our language?
Right.
Can we start talking about femicide?
So leave us with this, Karen. I mean, good reporting, and you gave, you know, some glimmers of it here and there, but what does it make possible for public understanding, for the survivors themselves, even policy decisions?
Yeah, I think, and not just I think, I mean, introducing language is important because it's important to be able to name a specificity of a crime. And it's important to be able to name specificity of patterns, which then not only have, you know, criminology implications, but so that we can form policy-targeted solutions. So targeted solutions to what I would say is a femicide problem that we have in this country, right? Mm-hmm. Allows us to target resources more effectively at the national, state, and local level to be able to help not only help victims, but also to impose harsher consequences. There should be harsher consequences for killing women, whether they're your wife, your girlfriend, your children. This should be, we shouldn't be in an arena where, oh, it's another DV case, oh, or it's another gun violence case, right?
Excellent points. Karen Atiyah, journalist, commentator, and author of The Golden Hour. You can find that on Substack. If you made it this far in the podcast, thank you for listening. And remember, if you or someone that you know needs assistance, call the Illinois Domestic Violence Helpline at 877-863-6338. For a look at the top stories of the day in Chicago and Illinois. As always, we spoke with WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane, and WBEZ weekend anchor and reporter Michael Puente was also on today's panel. There's a lot going on. Over the weekend, Mike, a Chicago police officer was killed. Another one was shot in front of a hospital. Catch us up on what happened in front of Swedish Hospital.
Well, basically, according, you know, based on some of the reports out there, especially from our colleagues with the Chicago Sun-Times, there was a man who was on parole who was arrested for a robbery, and somehow he was injured from that, took him to Swedish hospital. They said he was wanded at security, meaning I guess he was searched for weapons, mm-hmm. and somehow he got a hold of a gun where he used it, and one officer died because of it. Another one is in critical condition, and he escaped, but they got him back, and he's in custody right now.
Oh, wow. So it was one whole escapade. Oh, my goodness.
Right.
But he's back in custody, and he's been since identified as John Bartholomew.
Well, that's the officer who passed away.
Okay.
And 26-year-old Alfonso Talley, the South Side of Chicago, he's the one that is charged with murder, and attempted murder, and a number of felonies, and he's expected to be in court this morning.
Okay. Claire, turning to other news, the CTA broke ground on a new station. Why is this a big deal?
It's significant because it's one of the four new planned stations in this lengthy, looming Red Line Extension project.
Okay. Yeah, the future of the Red Line Extension, that's been up in the air. So sort of catch us up.
Yeah. So remember when future CTA infrastructure projects were threatened by federal funding cuts from the Trump administration?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that money is still sort of in limbo. And the certainty of this entire project, like many other planned CTA projects, like there's an ongoing Brown Line reconstruction project at Western, still unclear. But this is a step toward continuing the work as planned, the groundbreaking significant in that sense, and assuming that the funding will continue to come in. Sun-Times reporting that the CTA nearly suspended this construction last month after the Department of Transportation froze $2 billion in grants for this project while it claimed to examine some of the transit agency's hiring practices.
So when might we find out whether or not that $2 billion will be permanently available for the CTA?
Right. So a temporary court order unfroze those funds, hence why we were able to begin this construction. And a judge in June will examine, I guess, whether to release the funding permanently or this will continue to be held up in court, TBD.
Well, while we're making progress on building up train stations, Claire, our city bridges, they may be falling apart.
Yes.
What is going on?
Well, there's a lot going on with our bridges. Anybody that's been commuting in and around the downtown area knows this. Lots of traffic headaches, but about 17% apparently of the city's 601 bridges were listed as structurally deficient. Ooh. This was a latest Sun-Times analysis found that it's more than twice the national average of structurally deficient bridges.
Reporting from the Sun-Times, David Struitt says one in six Chicago bridges is in poor condition. I mean, how worried should we be here? I don't want any bridges in poor condition. I don't know about you.
Right. So the designation does not necessarily mean the bridge is going to fail and you're going to, you know, fall into the river. But it does warrant more regular inspections, more upkeep. As we know, though, many of the city's closed bridges, they're closed because they're being worked on right now. Sadly, that means because they need to be almost overhauled and rebuilt completely, mm-hmm. that a lot of these bridges are going to take some time before they are reopened.
Which bridges are we talking about?
So the heavy hitters are Chicago Avenue, also Halsted Bridges. They are currently under construction, closed until the end of this year. Cortlandt Street Bridge, many use that as a little sneaky cut around on the west side. That's going to be closed until mid-2027. And as we know, downtown, the 110-year-old State Street, or rather Lake Street Bridge, and not set to reopen until 2028, but it has closed that State and Lake CTA station for the time being.
Mike, you've got good news. Chicagoans are expected to live longer. Is that right?
That's right. Chicagoans are expected to live longer than ever before. That's according to new data from the Chicago Public Health Department that covers 2024. It shows that on average, Chicagoans can expect to live until they're 80 years old, up slightly from 2023. Black Chicagoans made up the most gains. They've added almost 6 years on average to their lives since COVID-19 pandemic. There's still a 20-year gap in life expectancy between the neighborhoods in the Loop and say West Garfield Park. Mm-hmm. So there's still that
discrepancy.
And we should shout out Kristen Schorsch, who's been reporting on this, especially on the west side, neighborhoods Garfield Park, East Garfield Park. I mean, she's been in this community for what seems like the last year, talking to people, analyzing a lot of this health data, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of great reporting being done.
I think Kristen's been on this for more than the last year. So yes, absolutely. Kudos to WBEZ's Kristen Schorsch. Now, it is a bit gloomy outside, Claire.
It was
dark and gray driving in.
I was going to say, did you think of me again when you were in your driveway and you're looking up
at
the sky?
Every time I'm upset with the weather, I think of you.
It is.
And I'm like, how could she do this?
Today, uniquely gray. After, actually, it was a pretty mild weekend. Got a little chilly yesterday, but we had a lot of sunshine. Not the case today. We've actually got some severe weather threatening the Chicago area. Going to come in a couple of phases today. Around now until maybe noon or 1, we're going to see some heavy rain, some downpours, and then thunderstorms. Meteorologists are saying between 2 and 4 is when we could see some of the really damaging winds, gusts between 20 and 60 miles per hour. This is across the region.
Oh,
keep that in mind. Also, some large hail possible. Tornadoes are possible as well, but the National Weather Service says that that will be mainly south of Kankakee. So us in the city, we're going to be dealing with the potential for hail, wind, and downpours.
Boy, oh boy.
Your faves.
Yeah.
All of them
happening at the same time. Mike, Governor Pritzker is putting pressure on state lawmakers in Springfield. He wants them to stop the Bears from moving to Indiana. What is he saying?
That's right. He's saying lawmakers need to move fast on a plan to keep the Bears from crossing the state line. The proposal, which passed the House last week, would allow the team to negotiate reduced or special payments, you know, and property tax assessment freezes to build the new stadium in Arlington Heights. The Bears, for their part, said in a statement, the bill still needs more work, but lawmakers only have until May 31st to get the bill passed and onto the governor's desk. So people on the other side of the state line can tell you right now, they're kind of like, no, take your time. You'll be fine.
It's a long con.
I talked to folks down there last week and in Indiana, in Hammond, and I tell you, they still feel there's a sense of hope that they could still move over across the state line.
It ain't happening.
I'm sorry, I don't know.
I think that they really did a nice job, the Bears, in playing this really straight for a very long time. But as you know, I mean, you had Mayor Johnson on the show. Governor Pritzker has been adamant. Lawmakers are like, we will move mountains to keep the Bears in Illinois. And I think that the work that they want to see, unfortunately for Michael Puente and his Hoosiers, is going to get done.
It's going to get done.
All right,
I agree. But we'll keep an eye for sure. What are you following, Mike, in the news?
Well, of course, ongoing with what's happening with the Bears and see if that's going to cross the state line over there. But, you know, there's so many stories that are happening every day. You know, it's a free-for-all.
Yeah. I hear that you did something interesting this weekend.
That's right. Like a lot of people, me and my family went to go see the new Michael Jackson movie.
Okay.
And it did not disappoint.
So you've got good reviews because I've been seeing the you know, people are up and down about it. It's mixed. I do see a lot of people saying it's phenomenal. The his nephew, Jafar, does an excellent job.
That's right. You know, I mean, I think there was a lot of things in there that I didn't realize. And I don't want to do any spoilers, but I think if you're a Michael Jackson fan, I think you're going to enjoy this film. If you're not, maybe you're more critical eye. You're wondering why some things are missing.
Yeah.
There's been talk about why there needed to be reshoots or not even talked about that. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, if you're a Jackson fan, you are not going to be disappointed.
We'll leave it there. That's WBEZ's Michael Puente and Claire Lane. Thanks for listening to In the Loop. I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons. Join me here every weekday for in-depth coverage of Chicago news and culture. Let's talk again soon.